Do you ever look at your kids and think, they've got it easy? Life was so much harder back in my day. Well, have I got the podcast for you. It's called Wait, They Did What? We take a trip back in time to when kids could buy fireworks, cars didn't have seatbelts, and we all had to sing God Save the Queen.
They did what?
They did what?
They did what?
I can't believe that.
Check it out with your kids. Wait, They Did What? Is on ABC Listen and ABC iView.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome back to History or Hoarding. I'm Annabelle Crabb. The year is 1973. It's a Friday. Friday, March the 16th. In Sydney, everything is pretty normal, except there's an unusually high number of coin collectors in town. There's not that many coin collectors in Australia, but the ones that there are very, very serious people. They are called numismatists. That's the magical word for those who specialise in rare coins. And in March 1973, they'd flocked to Sydney. The State Library of New South Wales had a special treat for these visiting coin nerds. It was an exhibition for one day only of rarities and treasures from the famed Dixon collection, usually held very securely under lock and key. Among the moths drawn irresistibly to this numismatic flame was a famous expert from Melbourne, Mr. Ray Jewell. Now, Ray Jewell was the kind of man who could spot a genuine 1852 Adelaide Assay Office gold piece by feel alone in his pocket. I don't know if that's actually true, but the man definitely knew his coins. So Ray's at the exhibition, of course, chatting away companionably with other numismatists, canopy in hand perhaps, who knows, when he peers down at a case of Dixon's colonial era gold coins. And he does a double take. And then he peers a little closer.
And the people asked, what do you think of the exhibition? He said, oh, it's very nice, but when are we going to see the real ones?
Catastrophically for the library, Ray Jewell's assessment was absolutely correct. Some of the library's most precious coins had indeed been swapped out for fakes. This sickening discovery was the beginning of a detective mission that would consume the greater part of a decade and unveil one of Australia's most ornate charlatans, a charming library regular with a side hustle in forgery. A man of mystery.
He had an amazing number of aliases.
A restaurateur and entertainer.
He was generous, you see. He invited people and gave them free drinks and things like that.
A man of varied interests, like ballroom dancing and adult entertainment.
He had a reputation for that, striptease, clubs
right.
And things.
This man had close to 70 fake identities. Some people knew him simply as Goldfinger. But we're going to use the name that the court system uses for him. David G., a man who charmed the pants off some librarians and managed to steal some of the most valuable pieces of this nation's heritage. So the story of David G. and his great coin heist is an incredible yarn, but it's also a good demonstration of the paradox facing public hoarding institutions. On the one hand, these collections belong to everyone, and we use taxpayer dollars to preserve and display them. And the corollary of that is that any taxpayer has the right to see them on request. But what happens when that taxpayer has dark intentions?
Oh my God, I'm actually perspiring with excitement. Wow, is it just me or is it incredibly warm in here?
This is Julia O'Shea. It is a perfectly normal temperature in here. Julia is our intrepid researcher here on History or Hoarding, and this story's been a real beast to research because even though many people at the library have heard terrifying tales of the Great Coin Heist, a lot of the people who were around at the time aren't around anymore. And David G. himself is dead.
David G. is no longer around.
It's like one of those stories that's just floating around in a million different glittery pieces, and You, I think, now are probably, of anyone that I know, the person who has spent most time pulling it together. And that's why, oddly enough, instead of interviewing somebody from the library, today I'm enlisting you.
Here I am.
But there are some people who were around and alive at the time who are still living, breathing and remembering. And one of them is a numismatist.
Correct. And his office is, somewhat conveniently, across the road from the State Library of New South Wales, across the pedestrian crossing.
So that is how the two of us came to be seated across the table from a leading numismatist.
William James Noble. Title is Managing Director of Noble Numismatics.
And it's his voice that you heard at the very top of this episode.
I'm turning 80 this year, so won't be too much longer and you won't be able to talk to anybody who was actually there.
So to describe Jim's knowledge of coins as encyclopedic actually feels like an understatement.
We did sell in 78 an Adelaide pound for...
The Rolodex of coins that he flips through in his mind.
Including a British trade dollar and a Hong Kong dollar.
It just kind of never ends.
Because they're like fingerprints, coins. Yeah. There's only one.
And in the course of his work as a numismatist, Jim met David G.
Whenever he did things or talked to you, it was almost mesmerising and you couldn't get a word in. He was that excited about his coins. And he had a lot of good coins.
And David G's obsession with coins started at a pretty early age, right?
Yeah, right. So he arrived with his family in Australia when he was really little. He was 10.
From where?
From China.
Right.
And they set up a series of businesses. His family owned a fruit shop in Surry Hills, I believe. And he didn't have a whole lot of education, David. He was being tutored in English, but he didn't really attend school. He was, though, running the books for the family's businesses. And in his early 20s, he heard about some coins that he was enamored with, apparently, and he just had to have. And he put a mortgage on two of his dad's properties.
He was just fascinated with rarities and a passionate collector. Yeah, he just had to have everything. That was his downfall, really.
The coin collecting actually wasn't even the half of it at the early stage of his life. He was into the stamps. It was the first real run-in that he had with the law was the stamp stuff.
Ah,
yeah.
Okay.
There were stamps that were discovered in the United States with a collector and they're identified as forgeries and they tracked these stamps back to a garage that was in G's name in Sydney. This is in the 60s. The hilarious thing about the story is that when he was on trial, the judge, he was quite annoyed about this. He's like, I must have more information on these stamps. Who is the finest expert on Chinese stamps in Australia? And the response was, regrettably, Your Honour, the accused, Mr. G, is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The defendant is also the expert.
Yeah.
Is that when he starts travelling under a bunch of different names?
Oh, the names, the pseudonyms. There are so many of them. In fact, I do have a list and we haven't got them in yet. So we've got Robert Lowe with an E, James Bond.
No.
Peter Evans, Chu Yon G, Philip G, CYG.
Sounds like a man trying to remember his password. That's right. Okay, so is it fair to say that as his life moved along and his pseudonyms proliferated, that he really focused on coins?
Yep, and he was particularly interested in the gold coins.
Right.
So David G got more and more bold. And the point in 1973, which is where we began, where Ray Jewell looks at a cabinet of coins in the State Library of New South Wales and goes, these are fantastic, thank you. When do we get to see the real ones? That was the work of David G.
Okay, so he's somehow managed to switch out the original valuable gold coins from the Dixon collection and pocket the originals. But these coins are locked away in a safe. How do you get into the safe, take the coins and replace them with fake ones?
This is exactly what no one knew. They ran a really extensive trial in the late 70s called 90 Witnesses. And at the end of it, he was convicted of theft and forgery, but questions still remained about exactly how he'd done it. The Sydney Morning Herald did a big write-up about it, 3-part series, and they were like, yeah, and it's a bit of a shame that no one knows how it happened. So
how did he? I mean, you're the researcher.
No, the librarians knew how he did it.
This is Rosie Block interviewing Joy Story. Joy, you've kindly responded to my invitation to come in and talk about the library during your time here in your various roles. And I'm going to start off with asking you please to give your full name and to spell it.
My first name is Rosemary, Rosemary. My second name is Joy, the name by which I'm generally known. And my surname is Story, spelled Storie.
Now, I'm just going to say, back up the truck, Joy Story?
Joy Story.
Joy Story, librarian.
That's right. In 2005, like, interesting example of the kind of stuff that the library holds onto, they've got an oral history with her that chronicles a whole bunch of stuff, her life, her childhood.
As having been born.
The Joy Story story.
The Joy Story story, if you will. And then the interviewer says...
And tell me, Joy, you know, about the great coin heist.
Ah,
please.
The great coin heist. Well, we had a Chinese gentleman that we knew as Mr. Low.
This was one of David G's aliases.
He was always squeaky clean. He smelt a bit like Lifebuoy soap. And he always looked as if he'd just finished pressing his shirt, always a blue shirt tucked in.
There's one photo of him that we've seen. His pants are slightly too short for him, bless him, but he's wearing like the most fabulous white shoes. And he was, by all accounts, kind of full of life.
Very cheery, a loud, booming voice, would stride in the mornings and he would slap people on the back, whether they were staff or readers, other readers. And most of us responded with a big smile back. But
he would come up the stairs and walk into the Dixon.
He'd walk straight into the Dixon room and just greet everybody.
There was this one particular librarian called Bess Cook. She was the boss of the Dixon collection at the time, who hated the idea of any of the peace being disturbed.
And Bess Cook used to cringe because she liked absolute quiet in the library.
Total old school shusher. So she was not a fan.
And so when he came into the library, he would ask to see coins themselves.
Yeah, in ample number.
These incredible coins that were used early on in the period of the colony.
And yeah, in order to get access to that kind of material, you had to at that stage at the library prove that what you were doing was for research. And so he told a little fib, first one of his life, so you can forgive him for it, about the fact that he was going to be writing a book about the history of Australia's gold coins, and that's why he needed special access.
There was a rule whenever the coins were in use that a member of staff was stationed there to keep an eye on them all the time. The coins at no time were allowed to be out of the sight of the member of staff.
Which meant that the librarian that was stationed
that
in
was
there
their
with
job.
Him, that became their job.
Could you do other work while you were
no,
watching?
Not at all.
You just had to sit there.
Just had to sit there looking at the coins.
Yes.
When he came in every day,
yes.
As if he was on the staff.
Something like 2 hours at a time.
No, day after day, like sort of 10 till 5 or 10 till 4 every day.
Did you sit with him every day?
Yeah, Jane? With a break for lunch.
Unable to do your manuscript cataloguing at all?
Mm-hmm.
So was he sketching them? Was he photographing them?
He was certainly looking at them. Maybe he was sketching. And then he brought in a camera.
Oh.
You know, one of those that you look from above, like a microscope, that has a little platform on which you place your item to be photographed.
This became Joy's job. This is how it went for Joy. Day after day after day, G would look at these coins. He'd take photos. And Joy would watch G watching the coins.
Very boring job.
But he hasn't actually done anything illegal at this point, has
no,
he?
No, that's right. Everything that he's been doing up until this point at the library has been very much by the book.
Annoying.
Annoying but legal.
So, of course, one got to chatting with the person who was using the coins because most of the time they're sitting there studying them with a magnifying glass or taking notes about them, and so they're free to talk. And I asked Mr. Lowe about his life. I said, is it a coins a hobby with you, or is it, do you have a numismatic business? What is your interest? He said, part hobby, part business. Anyway, after many days of boredom watching the coins, he'd finished. And he said goodbye to everybody, and he popped in at Christmas.
There's an amazing story about one Christmas when he came into the library with champagne for them.
Bottles of Bollinger for all the staff, you know, this case of Bollinger. And strode in, and Bess Cook said, no, no, and she got up from her seat at the back of the library and came hurrying as fast as she could to the front, she waving her arms in absolute panic, saying, no, no, we can't accept gratuities of any kind. No, take them away. We can't take them. And he looked irritated. It was the first time I'd ever seen him look irritated. He frowned and he stopped smiling.
He was like, but it's Christmas, and he supposedly dumped them on the desk and turned around and walked out. Phase one of his research at the library was complete, and unbeknownst to anyone else apart from David G, he had then a grand plan, which was to use the skills of other professionals in the coin creating business to effectively make copies of the coins from the State Library's collection.
Okay, so he's using these photographs that he said are central to his plan to write a book about the history of Australian coins, and he's actually using them to make fake ones.
That is exactly what he was doing.
Okay, yeah. So, all right, I get that. He's a forger. Forger's gonna forge. But, like, at the end of this process, he's ended up with a set of reproductions of the priceless coins that are in the library's collection, but those coins are still in the safe. So how does he get them and swap them for the fakes that he has?
Phase three, David G returns to the library.
Oh, poor Joy Story.
Joy Story is dragged into phase three.
Well, time passed, and I don't know what month it was he came back, but it was after November anyway, because he came in and said that on Guy Fawkes Night, his son, one of his sons, had inadvertently set fire in the study and with a firecracker, and his photographic collection had gone up in flames, and he would now have to re-photograph all the coins.
And they all looked at each other and said, are you kidding me? We're going to have to do all of this again.
Bess Cook said, oh, all right. You know, she talked to us about it, but she said, we can't refuse him. Anyway, he brought in the camera.
He brought in, actually, a camera that looked slightly different to the camera that he brought in the first time. Can you tell where this is going?
Could you describe the start? He came in with the photo, with
yes,
the camera.
He came in with the same camera, or it looked like the same camera, except that this time it was surrounded on three sides by plywood.
So it was in a plywood box.
So that when he was fiddling around to place things on the platform, I could see neither his hand nor the object. Okay. And then he said, when I asked him why he had the walls around it, he said it contained the light better and concentrated the light better.
And she can't see it, so she goes, wait. Takes the coins, folds the coins up, takes them away, puts them away, goes to Bess, her boss.
I went to Miss Cook and I said, I can't do this because I can't see the coins when he's photographing them. She went to consult the principal librarian, and as she came back, she said to me, he's been, you know, a long and regular user, and he's been very generous, and so we just feel, you know, we'll have to trust him.
No!
Yeah. What's the worst that he could possibly be doing? We know that he's going to be returning the coins, because if the coin slot is empty...
Okay, but, like, I remember getting a magic set where there was a little plastic thing that was like a drawer, and you'd put a coin in it, and then you'd shut it, and then you'd open it up again, and the coin would be
coin
gone.
The coin disappears.
Am I assuming that essentially what he is doing is a
grown-up variation on that most pathetic magic trick ever.
That's right.
So feeling that this was a farcical kind of thing, I had to sit there watching the coins as much as I could, but during the crucial periods, of course, unable to see them at all. And so we went through all these days and days of photographing, and then he finished again and said thank you with a big bright smile to everybody and left.
Okay, now some years go past, and it was less years than David G would have liked, actually. It was quite a shame that the event that brought Ray Jewell to town happened so recently after. Yeah. It was like 2 years later.
Because there's no reason why the librarians would necessarily have noticed, right? Because you've got to have an expert eye to spot a fake coin.
Totally. They're experts in a lot of stuff, but this level of detail takes a numismatist.
That's numismatics for you. Can really turn. You think you're doing fine and then bang, lady luck. Okay, I'm so invested in Joy's story now. I need to know that she didn't get in trouble.
One day I was asked to go urgently upstairs to the Dixon Library. And when I got up there, there was Bess and the principal librarian and another man whom I had never met, who turned out to be a numismatist, and another man who apparently was from the Crown Solicitor's office. And I was quizzed very closely about the experiences with Mr. Lowe. Did you complain about? I said yes, and I looked at Bess, and she agreed that I had complained that I couldn't see the coins. And so everything was completely out in the open and completely honest about what had happened at that point.
It was really tough for Bess. It was more tough for Bess than it was for Joy, Joy's
Bess
recollection. Bess was the boss, and she was fastidious. She was like the archetype librarian.
The sort of person who would really feel that.
She would have been waking up every day paranoid about the fact that something like this might happen, and then something like this has happened.
How did Miss Cook, cope with all of this? Very badly. She suffered a huge amount of stress as a result of this. I mean, she was the most conscientious person, but she was also the most nervous person, one of the most nervous people I've ever encountered. And, the sensibilities of someone like that, for something so horrendously important to happen under her watch, as it were, would just about destroy her sense of self-confidence. I mean, it was just terrible.
You see, he'd been a constant visitor for so long.
I understand how difficult that would have been. And I don't think I would have, in her position, I wouldn't have felt comfortable refusing permission either. Whether I would have or not, I have no idea. I suspect I might not have.
What could they have done?
Well, this is the thing, right? Because when you're a public collection and the collection is open to citizens of the place, then the open door policy is the open door policy, right? Like,
that's right.
If someone makes the effort to take out a ticket and ask to see something that is in this public collection, then you've got to show it to them.
Yeah.
Julia, I feel like we need one of those daytime movie end credit rolls here.
Right. David G served 3 years of his 7-year prison sentence.
Oh, yeah.
While in prison, he lost 2 fingers.
Of course he did.
Nobody knows exactly how.
That is perfect.
He lived until a ripe old age and he didn't get into trouble again.
Probably not enough fingers.
Or at least the artist known as David G didn't get into trouble again. It's hard to say exactly what happened to James Bond. For the library,
we have a new access rule. No one who looks at the coins is allowed to have any clothing on.
Wow, I imagine that's a slam shut a few coin escape routes. Maggie Patton, the librarian, was able to joke about it, but only just.
One of the things that they did as a result was to catalogue the collection in full.
I bet they just catalogued the hell out of that collection.
Right. They brought in their own cameras.
So we have digitised all of our coins so that we will always know if they're stolen, not that that will ever happen again, that we always have evidence of their condition so that if anything was to happen like that, we would be able to identify if it was the real coin or if it was a fake coin.
I
I was also fascinated to learn that A, they've still got some G forgeries in the collection, and B, that they can sell on the private market for thousands.
Absolutely. David G would have his fans and admirers among the numismatic community in Australia. And that's because he went to a lot of effort to create detailed and impressive forgeries. And David G isn't even the first to pull off something like this.
There is one more weird numismatic fact that I need to throw in before we wrap it. And it's the fact that the first coins struck in this country were made by a guy who was a convict, and he was here because he'd been forging coins at home in England.
So deported for forging.
That's right. He'd been making British pounds and they sent him to a new colony on the other side of the world for doing so. And he made our first currency here.
At the order of the governor?
Yeah, Governor Macquarie, the fifth governor of New South Wales, went, William Henschel, come on down. Here's a workshop. You're going to be making some coins for us.
Oh, that is outstanding. So fraud is baked into numismatics.
Yes, all David G was doing was continuing a long-held tradition.
God, after that tale, I kind of need to lie down. But next time, we're going to look at items that don't need to be kept safe from the public, but items from which the public needs to be kept safe.
And he writes a letter to the library and he says, you need to send someone to my house. I have something that you need for the collection. Do not send a woman.
Gracious.
The contents of these letters are too shocking for a lady. And so someone goes and collects the letters and brings them back.
History or Hoarding is made on the lands of the Gadigal people. It's written and presented by me, Annabelle Crabb, with research by Julia O'Shea. Harvey O'Sullivan is our audio engineer. Rachel Cusick is our supervising producer. And Carmel Rooney is our executive producer.